This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today we're going to listen to Terry's interview from earlier this week with Bruce Dern. He won the Best Actor Award at this year's Cannes Film Festival for his performance in the new film Nebraska. After spending much of his career in supporting roles, Dern is loving getting this recognition at the age of 77. Dern started his acting career doing guest shots on TV shows, such as Route 66, Surfside 6, Ben Casey, Wagon Train, and Gunsmoke. In the 60s, he co-starred in several Roger Corman movies, including the biker film The Wild Angels and the psychedelic film The Trip, which was written by Jack Nicholson. Dern co-starred with Nicholson in the 1972 film The King of Marvin Gardens. Dern was nominated for an Oscar for his performance in the 1978 film Coming Home. Dern's new film, Nebraska, was directed by Alexander Payne. The story starts in Billings, Montana, where Dern's character, Woody, who is beginning to show signs of dementia, falls for one of those junk mail sweepstakes come-ons. Not having read the fine print, he believes he's won $1 million and that all he needs to do is redeem the certificate at an office in Lincoln, Nebraska. Since he can't drive anymore, Woody starts walking there from Montana. In this scene, one of his sons, played by former Saturday Night Live player Will Forte, has been driving around looking for him. And after the son finds his father, he tries to reason with him.
Come on, let me take you home.
I'm going to Lincoln. It's the last thing I do. I don't care what you people think.
Listen to me. You didn't win anything. It's a complete scam. So you got to stop this, okay?
I'm running out of time.
You didn't even have a suitcase.
I'm not staying there.
Dad, I can't let you go.
It's none of your business.
Yes, it is. I'm your son.
Well, then why don't you take me?
I can't just drop everything and drive to Lincoln, Nebraska.
Oh, what else you got going on?
Bruce Dern, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on getting the Best Actor Award at Cannes for your performance in this film. What did you identify with in the character? On the surface, your life is so different from the character of Woody's. You're from a kind of privileged background, not from poverty like he is. You've had a fulfilling career. I assume it's been fulfilling. And from all reports, you're a talker, not the kind of man of few words that Woody is.
Well, I relate to the fact that I've always been a person that listened, heard, saw, smelled, whatever the five senses are around me 24/7. And so what I had to do was get rid of all of those instincts, to shut things out, to not be aware of the conversations that were going on around me. And if I couldn't see somebody looking me in the face where I could look at their lips, so if I missed a word or two, I would know what it was they were saying, and just not deal with it. If you're standing at home plate and looking out on a baseball field, all the lights in right field are out in Woody. So he's got about two-thirds of the lights that are still on, but he's playing a night game, so he misses quite a bit. And then there's always the thing of, does he miss everything? Well, no, he doesn't. So it's that kind of fine line walk about what he wants to hear, he hears, and what he doesn't. And having the ability to do that and make it believable on screen was my biggest challenge. The spaciness, the being out there.
Well, let me say something about the spaciness. First of all, I read, I think it was in the New York Times, that you turned off your hearing aids during some of the scenes.
I took them off completely.
So that, because you were just describing how you're always so tuned in, all your senses are tuned in, and you had to stop that. So when you took out your hearing aids, how did that affect your performance?
Huh? That's how it affected it. You know what I'm saying?
Do you think that you're getting to the age where you fear people think that of you sometimes, that you're not, that
oh,
you're
I
not
think
getting
they've been
it?
Thinking that, I think they've been thinking that of me since I was probably 17. My family had a hard time hearing me, which is one of the reasons I became an actor in the first place, because I felt, well, at least emotionally, they could get what's going on with me. If I could tap that and be able to do that in the theater or when the switch is on in film or something like that. But they never got it one way or the other. They just thought it was I have an uncle named Archibald MacLeish, who was a well-known poet and playwright, and he won, I think, 3 Pulitzer Prizes and was Librarian of Congress for a long time. And I asked my mother one time, why are you so down on me deciding that I'm going to be an actor and I'm making a living at it? And you put it down, and yet with Archie, you give him a pass. My name's Bruce MacLeish Dern, and Archibald MacLeish was my uncle. And she said, because Archie's an artist, Bruce. I said, really? Why is that? Because he's a man of letters.
Mm.
Oh, really? And what's that make me? She said, you're spending your life making money pretending.
Well, this was the era before most people took film that seriously. You know, it was, right? I mean...
Oh, it was late 50s.
Yeah.
Mid to late 50s.
I mean, your parents obviously weren't like cinéastes or anything.
Well, I mean, she would say to me, you know, instead of write when you get work, write when you become Jimmy Stewart, write when you become Clark Gable or Gary Cooper or whoever she knew was in the movies in those days. It was like, what have you done for us lately? What are you doing for the Dern name? What are you doing for the MacLeish name? Oh, my God.
Oh, little did she know.
You know,
I mean, you've done a lot for that Dern name.
Well,
your daughter, Laura Dern.
She passed away in 1972. And in 1969, after a decade in the business, she was all upset. She called me on the phone one day and she says, why don't you cut all this nonsense out? You come back, you and Andrea, who's my wife, you come back here. You can live with me. I'll put you through law school. You can go to work at the store. In the meantime, the store being Carson Perry Scott and Company, which the MacLeish family was the Ann Company of, and their father had started it. And you can get all this acting silliness out of your system by doing plays, little plays at the Goodman Theater in Chicago. And I said, well, but I am making a living, and I'm hanging in there. I'm not making a lot. And she said, well, every movie you're in, I can't take your grandfather to see. And I don't want to see it. She said, they're always about drugs or motorcycles, or this is 1969, or all these other things. And now you're in yet another Western. And I just can't, your grandfather doesn't like Westerns. He doesn't like the West. He doesn't like anything about it. He doesn't like anything west of Proviso, which is about 4 miles off of Lake Michigan, which is where we lived right on Lake Michigan. So when you start making movies that are important movies or mean something to people, then let us know. I said, what's wrong with the movie I'm in now? She said, it's a Western. I said, Mother, they shoot horses, don't they? It's not a Western.
Oh, that's so funny. That's a movie about, it's set in the Depression, and it's a dance marathon where people basically dance to the death in order to win a prize because everybody's so poor. That's so funny.
Right.
So it was the grandfather who didn't want to see Westerns. Was that your grandfather who was the former Utah governor?
No.
That was another grandfather.
Mr. Bruce MacLeish. And there were 3 boys who were the sons of Andrew MacLeish, who brought the store from Scotland to Chicago. And then Archie went on to become a poet, went back east. Norman went on to become a painter. And Bruce stayed home and ran the family store. And that was the MacLeish side. The Dern side is the one that my grandfather Dern was the one of the first non-Mormon governors of Utah, and then was the governor from 1924 to 1932. And then President Roosevelt made him the Secretary of War in his first cabinet. And then he passed away while he was still in office.
Now, I read that when you decided to drop out of college, the University of Pennsylvania, and go to New York to study with Ilya Kazan at the Actors Studio, that your parents disowned you. Did they literally disown you?
Well, my father was a trustee of the University of Pennsylvania and had been a very famous athlete there and edited the Penn Law Review when he graduated from law school there, and it was a big deal. And his dad then had just become, by the time he got out of law school, had just become the, started his second term as the governor of Utah. So at that time, in 1956, I had sideburns about the size of a third less than Elvis Presley's sideburns, who was the sideburn king of the day. And the coach of the track team was a Quaker named Ken Doherty, who was a great coach, really. And I was a good runner at Penn. I wasn't a phenom or anything like that, but I did very well. And he told me to cut the sideburns off. You know, he said, the ivy on your face is not Ivy League. Oh, thank you, coach. He says, cut them off or you're not going to run for the school anymore. So I refused to cut them off. And I mean, they weren't obnoxiously long or anything like that. He says, you're not a team player. And I said, well, are the other people complaining about it? No, I'm complaining about it. I'm your coach and they're coming off. So I left college. And my father backed the school and not me. And that was the beginning of a winding down of my relationship toward him. And then I went to a little dramatic school there for a little while and realized there were three things you had to do. You had to go to New York, you had to try and become a member of the Actors Studio, and you had to try and work for Mr. Kazan. And those were the things that I tried to do and did.
So let's get to your Oscar nomination, which is from the movie Coming Home in 1978, which is either the big or at least one of the first big movies about Vietnam veterans coming home. And it was very significant because of that. And you play a vet who's come home to your wife, played by Jane Fonda, to find that she's been having an affair with another vet who returned home paralyzed from the waist down, and that vet has become an anti-war, a vet against the war. So in this scene, like, you've come home and you're really angry, she's trying to explain herself to you, and you're not having any of it.
I love you. I do. I'm not going to make excuses for what happened. It happened. I needed somebody. I was lonely. It's not... Bob, please.
God damn it, it's bull. Everybody needs somebody, for Christ's sake. If it's over with us, it's over.
Well, what are you saying? That you're not even going to make the effort?
What I'm saying is I do not belong in this house. Please. And they're saying that I don't belong over there.
So my guest, Bruce Dern, with Jane Fonda in a scene from the 1978 movie Coming Home. How did that movie change your life and your career?
Well, I think the movie got a lot of recognition, but I just think that it gives people a different spin on who you have been before and what you've done before. And it's kind of a calling card. You know, it's kind of saying, hey, well, he's always been pretty good. Now he's really good in this movie that we all are touched by, and it says something. And that was an acceptance I had never had up to that time, although I'd been in some, you know, good movies. I mean, King of Marvin Gardens is a wonderful movie, but it never got discovered by major audiences. Smile is a good movie, never got discovered. Even Our Great Gatsby didn't do particularly well at the box office.
So Coming Home was kind of a breakthrough role for you, and it brought you to a new level of recognition. What about on the home front? Did your parents kind of appreciate the breakthrough was?
They were all gone.
They were dead by then?
No, they were all passed away. None of my parents or that part of my family ever saw any work after.
Is that hard for you, that you were never able to, like, say to them, look, it actually happened. I made a career. I did good by the family name. You would have enjoyed these films?
Well, without being a... I don't know what the word I should use is, but without being, overly bearing or saying a witness of it, of how I respond to all that, takes you right to Nebraska when I go through the old house. That's the most personal scene I've ever done in my career. And the whole movie is the most personal movie I've ever done in my career, both my role and the movie. I mean, Alexander gets after it, and he goes beyond into the underbelly. And when I go through that house, you're seeing what I felt about the fact I didn't get the support that I needed when I was young. And up till I was, you know, I don't know, 34 years old, when they were all gone by then.
And what we're seeing, let's just explain this for our listeners who haven't seen the film yet. Your son decides, like, why don't we go back to the house that Dad grew up in and see what it was like for him? And the house is just, it's almost like a shack that's, like, falling apart. And
what do I say when they suggest it? They say, well, we want to go see it. What for?
What for? Yeah. I love that line because it's perfect. But you get there, and you're seeing, like, the place where your father used to beat you, right? And so talk a little bit about how what your character experience is going back.
Well, in that house, the first thing that you see is I say, this is my room. This was my room. And then my wife says, this is where Woody's little brother David died of scarlet fever when he was 2. And Woody slept in the same bed with him, which is a carryover from another scene, and never got it. And the son says to me, do you remember that, Dad? And this is where Bob Nelson is so brilliant at what he does, and Alexander Payne. Instead of giving an answer that you've heard many, many times, the answer that I say is, I was there. And then he goes into his parents' room. And in his parents' room, he says, this was my parents' room. And I'd get whipped if I was ever caught in here. And then I say, I guess there's nobody that's going to whip me now. And then I walk to the window and say, the barn is still there. And that's as hard a scene as I'll have in my career anywhere. Because it wasn't hard to do, because it's all there. And because of Mr. Kazan and Mr. Strasberg, that's the first place I go, is personally right away. And it was designed for that. Alexander and Bob Nelson knew nothing about that. But that's what I did in Nebraska that I've never done before in my career, was to do an entire movie that was based on something that Faden Papa Michael and Alexander said to me, Faden Papa Michael being the cinematographer, the very first day of filming. And that was, Bruce, we'd like you to do something for us in this movie I'm not sure you've ever done before. And I said, what's that? He said, don't show us anything. Let us find it.
What does that mean?
It means that don't perform the role. Don't add things that you don't need to add. Don't have a lack of confidence that the role works. And the reason you don't need to have that is because we're going to see all that, because the camera is going to be on you when you go through those things. And every other actor in the movie, it's on them. Because Alexander has the courage to stay longer in a shot so he can see the behavior evolving, rather than to cut away and cut back to keep everybody alive that's in the scene in the room. He stayed and studied the character. And of all the shots I've ever been in a movie I'm in, the most spectacular compliment of that to Alexander and Faden is when my old girlfriend comes out that store at the end of the movie as I drive by her, and you see that face. And if that's not once upon a time, I don't know what is. And he stays on it until you understand what she meant in her face, and what was going on, and what his movie meant. And that's magical stuff. And what was wonderful about it, it's all on the page.
So you were saying that you didn't tell Alexander Payne, the director of Nebraska, about your own memories of your own home and how that was going to resonate with the scene in which your character goes back to his family's home, to the home where he grew up.
Right.
Did you intentionally not tell them? Did you not want the rest of the people in the film to know until after that scene was over?
No, they don't know it to this day. Nobody. I mean, I just gave it to, you know, however many listeners you have out there, because it's the horse is out of the barn. But if you want to know what actors work on, I would never tell another actor what I was working on or anything else, because that's mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to go back and borrow that time and time again.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look back at the history, and I look into a room where there's a broken crib, and a child died in the room, Diane and I lost a child in a swimming pool at 18 months, 5 years before Laura was born. So it's readily right there at the surface. If you are willing to go there and open that door up into your heart and start there, those are the kinds of things you deal with.
You were not encouraged by your parents when you wanted to act. In fact, they actively discouraged you about acting. They were really opposed to your career. They had no respect for the work that you were doing. Your daughter, Laura Dern, is a successful actress and an excellent actress. How did you feel about her going into the business? I know there are so many actors and actresses who do not want their children to go into the business because it can be so difficult, and you are rejected so often in that business, even if you end up being successful. So what was your attitude toward her becoming an actress?
Well, Laura was lucky in a way that she lived in a laboratory of actors that were going through exactly what you're talking about. But early on, she realized that she wanted to express herself, and she wanted it to be more than just to her couple of friends. She wanted to express herself because she had ideas, she had feelings, and so she did it. And the only instruction I gave her early on was, number one, learn to dance, not dancing lessons. But in my career, the greatest crippler of actors to me is behind the camera intimidation. And you cannot take it personally. You have to dismiss that, otherwise it'll interfere with anything you're going to do at your work. Meaning that you do a take, they cut. Immediately you know they're talking about you. Immediately they say they're going to do take two. You know you screwed up. You know it's about you. You can't do that. They just all want to get out at 7 o'clock and go to the Laker game, for God's sake. I mean, that's, you know, everybody, they have their own lives, and actors have to get over the fact they're the most important thing on the set. They are not. And the second thing was, take risks. If you're going to take roles, go out on the edge of the cliff and take roles other people don't seem to do or want to do or have passed on for whatever reason, and do it. Take roles that the behavior might be abnormal, the circumstances might be abnormal, but go with that and trust that and learn from there. And she's done it fabulously, Laura. I mean, I'm so proud to be her dad. You have no idea, particularly in the range of, number one, who she is as a human being, and number two, the way she's embraced what both Diane and I tried to pass along to her, which is simple truth.
Bruce Dern stars in the new film, Nebraska. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. Texas-born tenor saxophonist Booker Irvin came to New York in 1958. Pianist Horace Parlin heard him and invited Irvin to sit in one night with a band he worked in. That was how Irvin got hired by bassist Charles Mingus, who featured him on such albums as Blues and Roots and Mingus Ah-Um. Before long, Irvin was making his own records. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue of Irvin's 1960 debut album called The Book Cooks.
Saxophonist Booker Irvin's sextet, playing a blues in the style of his sometime boss, Charles Mingus. It's from 1960's The Book Cooks, back out on the re-revived Bethlehem label. Irvin came from northeast Texas on the Oklahoma line, field hollers coming at him from the east and cattle calls from the west. He punctuated his lines with high, lonesome hollers before he got to New York and discovered John Coltrane had a similar move. Irvin got ideas from Coltrane after that, but that cry was always his own. Coltrane's tone was glossy as varnished hardwood. Booker Irvin's sound was more coarse, a cane stalk shooting up out of rich earth. For those ensemble shouts and background riffs, Booker Irvin is flanked by trumpeter Tommy Turrentine from Max Roach's band and a tenor saxophonist who traveled in different circles, Lester Young disciple and big band vet Zoot Sims. Zoot could blow cool, he'd once recorded with Jack Kerouac, but also liked locking horns with fellow tenors. The saxophonists square off in a friendly way on The Book Cooks. Zoot's tone is a little softer and rounder than Booker's. Booker Irvin and Zoot Sims, 1960, with Mingus' drummer Danny Richmond and Tommy Flanagan taming an untuned piano. The late 50s and thereabouts was a great period for jazz rhythm sections, mighty bass players in particular. Nowadays, most bassists set the strings low to the neck so their fingers don't have to fight so hard. Back then, strings were higher and players couldn't get around so quickly, but they could pluck a string so hard it made bass a percussion instrument. Listen to the great George Tucker's bass beat and how Danny Richmond's hi-hat and cymbals mail his message home. Trumpeter Tommy Turrentine playing the blues. The Book Cooks was Booker Irvin's first album under his own name, kicking off an early 60s hot streak. He'd make the classics The Freedom Book and The Space Book with another great rhythm section, and recorded other good dates involving Tommy Flanagan, George Tucker, or Danny Richmond. But what really makes all those records is Booker Irvin's Texas shout on tenor saxophone, a sound that's both down-home and majestic.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure, Downbeat, and E-Music, and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed the reissue of tenor saxophonist Booker Irvin's first album, The Book Cooks. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with Ali Brosh, creator of the humorous autobiographical blog Hyperbole and a Half. The blog has a huge following. It attracts several million unique visitors per month. In 2011, an editor of PC World included it in his list of the funniest sites on the web. And this year, Advertising Age included Brosh in its annual list of the year's most influential and creative thinkers and doers. Which is pretty amazing, considering that, as Brosh puts it, she lives like a recluse in her bedroom in Bend, Oregon, where she writes stories about her life and illustrates them with brightly colored, intentionally crude drawings. Most of the stories are funny, whether they're about her dog's behavior problems or her own. But her most popular posts have also been the most upsetting, about her crippling depression. Brosh's new book, also called Hyperbole and a Half, is a collection of her blog posts as well as new illustrated stories.
Ellie Brosh, welcome to Fresh Air. So how would you describe what you do?
I would describe it as stand-up comedy in book form. I feel like my writing style is sort of the result of me subconsciously trying to replicate the feel of stand-up comedy. I was very frustrated when I first started writing that there wasn't that physicality to it. It was more one-dimensional than stand-up comedy, which you can rely on tone and facial expressions, body posture. And I wanted to find some way to commit that to the page. And drawing fixed all those problems.
Another solution would have been to do stand-up comedy.
Yes. Unfortunately, stand-up comedy is live. And my thoughts tend to come out rapidly and partially deformed. So I don't know if I lend myself very well to stand-up comedy. I've always wanted to try it, though.
Well, it sounds like you're kind of reclusive and would prefer
yes.
to work at home.
Yes. I'm sort of a hermit. I work from my bedroom, and I enjoy that.
Would you describe for our listeners who haven't yet seen your blog or your book how you draw yourself and why you draw yourself that way?
All right. So I draw myself with very crude illustrations in a program called Paintbrush. It's sort of the Macintosh analog of MS Paint. And I look very funny. I've got these buggy eyes, and I have sort of like a tube body and a little like triangle ponytail thing on the top of my head. And it's a strange sort of animal-like creature. And the reason I draw myself this way is I feel that this absurd squiggly thing is actually a much more accurate representation of myself than I am. It's a better tool for communicating my sense of humor and actually getting across what I'm trying to say than, say, you know, being there in the flesh. I feel like it's actually one of the reasons why I don't do stand-up and why I do this instead. Because I can use this character to communicate and make it much more accurate and true to what I'm trying to say and true to my tone.
So what makes you feel like this image is an accurate representation of yourself? Because the image that you draw, it's kind of like you said, like a tube with like insect-like legs and two bug eyes and a couple of lines for a mouth and this triangle thing on your head that now I know is supposed to be a ponytail.
Well, yeah, it's open for interpretation. It can be a shark fin or a party hat. Some people prefer to think of it like that, and I'm all right with it not being interpreted as a ponytail anymore. I feel it's a more accurate representation of me because it's me on the inside. That's what I'm like when I view myself. I am this crude, absurd little thing, this squiggly little thing on the inside, and so it's more of a raw representation of what it feels like to be me.
And how did you start to blog, Allie? Actually, in asking you that question, I'm going to read the bio that's at the back of your book because it's very funny. And I assume
you
wrote it. I would say,
yeah.
So, okay, it says, Allie Brosh lives as a recluse in her bedroom in Bend, Oregon. In 2009, she thought, I know what would be a good idea. Instead of becoming a scientist, I should write and draw things on the internet. This was a horrible idea for too many reasons to count, but the decision wasn't really based on logic. Things sort of spiraled from there. So you were going to be a scientist before?
Yeah, I studied human biology in college.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to go into like biomedical research. And I sort of had a little bit of an identity crisis at the very end of college. I graduated and I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to do. I felt like maybe I was committing to the wrong path, and I was part of the cross-country and track team. And I still sort of wanted to take a stab at running professionally, and so that's originally what I tried to do. Unfortunately, I got hurt about 6 months into the process. I was able to support myself for a very short time running road races. The prizes varied dramatically. Sometimes you'd get, like, $500, sometimes you'd win a pumpkin. So that was how I was supporting myself for a good 6 months, and then I hurt my Achilles tendon, and there I was, unemployed, recent college grad, unemployed, and I needed something to do. And I'd been casually writing this blog for a little while. I started writing it in the summer before I graduated, so right before finals week, actually. I was procrastinating. I'm laterally productive. I will do productive things, but never the thing that I'm supposed to be doing. So I was supposed to be studying for a physics test, which I did eventually study for, but in this moment, I felt more like trying to write funny things. And I've always enjoyed the challenge of making people laugh. It's sort of a game for me. It's fun to see if I can do it. And so it was a very hastily done process. I just typed into Google, like, a free blog platform. And I found Blogger and created the blog. And then I wrote something. I'd actually written the first thing I posted. I had actually written before, but I posted it and got a couple comments. And slowly, you know, I get like 3, maybe 8 comments at a time. And that was huge for me, thinking that there are actual people out on the internet reading the things that I'm saying. And so that sort of kept me going. It was a hobby. And then once I injured my Achilles tendon and I was unemployed and didn't really have anything to do, I got much more into writing as a way to keep myself entertained or to have something to focus on.
When you were a child, you loved dogs, and you still do. And one of your really funny stories in here is about two of your dogs, and they're both rescue dogs from shelters. And you had a dog who wasn't very bright, so you thought that dog needed a helper dog. And
yeah,
you want to describe the situation?
Well, so we adopted our first dog, who I now call the simple dog. She is not very bright. She had trouble. She didn't know how to walk upstairs when we first adopted her. We had to teach her, and there was this funny moment where she got to the middle of the stairs. We had been placing treats on each stair to motivate her to go up further on the staircase, and she panicked in the middle of it and didn't know how to go up or down, and so that's sort of a funny moment. Anyway, so we adopted our simple dog, and probably about 3 or 4 months later, she lost her tags. And so we had to go to the shelter to replace her tags. And clearly that was, you know, we ended up with another dog after walking out of the shelter. And so this other dog, who we gleefully thought might be a helper dog to our simple dog, and she earned the title helper dog on the car ride home from the shelter while we were still thinking, like, oh, this will be great. She'll be like a service animal to our other dog. And as it turns out, the helper dog actually hates other dogs. She agreed to tolerate the simple dog, though, because the simple dog is very undog-like. She's more like some sort of sea creature cow hybrid. I'm not entirely sure. But they're friends, but the helper dog isn't actually very helpful.
So if you're just joining us, my guest is Allie Brosh, and she has a new book that, like her blog, is called Hyperbole and a Half, and it's her funny stories combined with cartoonish pictures that she draws to accompany them, which she says is the closest thing she could get to stand-up comedy on the page, or stand-up comedy with drawings. Probably the biggest response you've gotten to any of your blog posts, and these stories are in your new book, is they're the ones about depression. Mm-hmm. And there's two of them. Depression Part 1 and Depression Part 2. Were these two separate bouts of depression?
Yeah. Part 1 was sort of... I thought that was really like the final face of depression for me, but I was very wrong about that. Part 2 was a much more deep and subtle form of depression where I just didn't feel anything. The first part was all sorts of feelings and a lot of self-loathing involved in that. And then slowly it transitioned to feeling nothing and just feeling very detached and bored with everything because I couldn't connect in a meaningful way to the things I enjoyed or the things around me. It just felt totally detached and numb.
I'd like you to read an excerpt from Hyperbole and a Half, and this is from the section on depression.
Yeah, so this is sort of like the dark night of the soul moment in this whole series of posts. It's a strange moment when you realize that you don't want to be alive anymore. If I had feelings, I'm sure I would have felt surprised. I've spent the vast majority of my life actively attempting to survive. Ever since my most distant single-celled ancestor squiggled into existence, there's been an unbroken chain of things that wanted to stick around. Yet there I was, casually wishing that I could stop existing in the same way you'd want to leave an empty room or mute an unbearably repetitive noise. That wasn't the worst part, though. The worst part was deciding to keep going. When I say that deciding not to kill myself was the worst part, I should clarify that I don't mean it in a retrospective sense. From where I am now, it seems like a solid enough decision. But at the time, it felt like I had been dragging myself through the most miserable, endless wasteland, and far in the distance, I'd seen the promising glimmer of a slightly less miserable wasteland. And for just a moment, I thought maybe I'd be able to stop and rest. But as soon as I arrived at the border of the less miserable wasteland, I found out that I'd have to turn around and walk back the other way.
Did you tell anybody that you were actually considering suicide? That it was a serious thought in your mind?
Yes, I told my mom and my husband. And we talked it through. My mom was great about it. She said she broke down after she got off the phone with me. She broke down a little bit on the phone, but she actually worked at a suicide hotline for a long time. So she knew what to say and how to handle it.
What was it that she said?
You know, she treated it with validity. She didn't say, you know, no, don't do that. Like, that's ridiculous. She asked me questions like, well, why or what are you thinking of doing? Do you have a plan? And, like, I guess what's this like for you? And so she was just trying to figure out more what my psychological environment was. And that was comforting to me because, you know, she wasn't pushing me to do anything. She wasn't trying to jar me out of the spot that I was at with, like, positivity or anything like that. She sort of met me where I was and listened to what I had to say.
Did you have a plan?
I did. I was trying to figure out how to do it without, you know, upsetting the people I love. I was trying to maybe, like, how can I make it look like an accident or something that wasn't quite so purposeful so it would be less disturbing for my husband, who would have probably been the one to find me. And that's eventually what prevented me from doing it, is imagining how much I would hurt them.
What kind of accident were you planning?
Drowning. I was thinking maybe I would go out for, you know, one of the running trails that I normally run on. Sorry, I'm getting a little choked up.
Do you want to stop for a couple of minutes?
It's all right. And this was in the winter, and I was planning on maybe just sitting down in the river and getting hypothermic and allowing it to happen that way. And so anyone who found me would be like, oh, well, she fell in. And, it looks very accidental.
That would have been a really horrible way of doing it. I mean, it would have, that's like one of those really painful things to do where all the instincts in your body would be fighting against drowning yourself.
Yeah.
I don't mean.
Well, yes. Yeah. The hypothermia is what I was maybe hoping for, is that if, you know, it was, I feel like maybe it was January or February, and it was very cold. So I could have just submerged myself, you know, up to my chest and in water and just sat there until things took their course.
Well, so when you told, did you tell your husband you were actually seriously thinking about suicide?
I did. I don't know. This might actually be the first time he's hearing the details.
Oh. So I think one of the awful things about feeling suicidal and then letting somebody who is close to you know that is that it would be easy for them to interpret it as either A, you don't care enough about me to care what happens to me if you leave, or also I'm not loving you in an adequate way and that's why you're suicidal. Because if I was doing a better job being your mother or being your husband, you'd be happier and not be in this position. Is that like another thing that was going through your mind?
Well, there are a lot of complex emotions that arise, like these auxiliary emotions that happen with depression where, you know, the depression itself might not have any cause, but we're used to thinking in terms of causes and effects. And so it's natural to interpret it in that way. And so, yeah, he I'm sure that he felt, oh, well, there's maybe something that I should be doing better to, like, help you. And I had to explain, like, no, it's not you. It's, like, this is – I just can't take how numb everything is and how I can't connect to anything. It was driving me crazy to, you know, be with this person I love, like, the person I love the most in the entire world. And sorry.
It's okay.
And not be able to feel anything. And so I was able to explain, I feel, that it wasn't anything that any of them were doing. It wasn't, I know how much they love me. And that, in the end, was what kept me from doing it.
How did the depression end?
I mean, I don't know if it has fully ended. I feel like I'm operating at about 60% capacity now, but it's a comfortable spot for me. I actually enjoy where I am. I feel like I used to be a lot more anxious than this, but the slight numbness and emotional deadening allows me to be much less anxious. It's sort of like my depression cured my anxiety in a way.
So just like another question about the depression, was anything helpful? Was there like any kind of therapy or medication that alleviated some
medication way? Was very helpful. Mm-hmm. I take Wellbutrin. And that's been very helpful. My big concern with medication was that it would alter my brain in a way that wouldn't let me keep doing what I do, wouldn't let me keep writing, wouldn't let me be creative. I was really scared that it would change me. And Wellbutrin hasn't done that so far. I feel pretty much myself on it. And, you know, obviously there are times where the depression pokes through a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes. But it's never as bad as that, you know, the worst part. I feel like I approach a pretty numb state, but I don't ever devolve fully into that same place where I was.
Allie Brosh's blog is called Hyperbole and a Half, which also is the name of her new book. You'll find a longer version of Brosh's conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our assistant producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.